from Montana to Florida, New Mexico to New York, this is American Radio Journal. The Chinese government's long list of wrongdoing extends from the coronavirus to international spying to pollution of the environment. James Carafano of the Heritage Foundation is here with details. Congress passed an omnibus spending bill, including new economic stimulus measures, before adjourning for the Christmas holiday. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. That COVID-19 relief bill included some new restrictions on parental school choice rights. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Corey DeAngelis of the Reason Foundation. And the U.S. Supreme Court's refusal to hear the Texas election case was a dereliction of duty. So says Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. China's failure to warn the international community to contain COVID-19 unleashed a worldwide pandemic. But that is not the communist nation's only wrongdoing. James Carafano is Vice President for Foreign Policy and Defense Studies at the Heritage Foundation. He is here to talk about China's transgressions. Jim, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Jim, when we talk about China and the lies and deception that have just poured forth from that nation, particularly in recent months, let's talk first of all about COVID-19 and the Chinese record of non-transparency on COVID-19. Tell us a bit about that.
There's really two issues there. One is the Chinese hid from the international community, in part because they were hiding from the Chinese people how infectious and how novel the disease was and information about the disease. And second is that the Chinese didn't restrict international travel during a crucial period that really kind of spread the disease around the world. And so if you think about that, this isn't just subjective. I mean, this is actually confirmed recently in some reporting in which somebody had gotten a hold of some classified documents from the Chinese government that were leaked that reaffirmed all this. But if you think about this, if the Chinese had been up front, we could have started on a vaccine months earlier. And so today, we wouldn't just be approving vaccines. A good portion of Americans would already have it. And equally important, we could have gotten started on a testing regime right away. And with a testing regime, we could have probably stopped it at the border before it got into the country or localized outbreaks and prevented them from becoming a pandemic. So literally, everything that we have gone through the last year is because of the malfeasance of China. If they had acted correctly, we could have taken the measures to not go through much of the suffering that we have. And the fact that they continue to lie about this, very recently, the Chinese misinterpreted a report that was done out of Italy that said, hey, the cases in Italy appeared future sooner than anticipated, to try to suggest that maybe the disease started in Italy to begin with, even though the research did not say that. And the research is actually completely consistent with the disease coming out of China. So they continue to lie about this.
In the headlines in recent weeks, Jim, there has been a lot of reporting on Eric Swalwell, the Democratic congressman from California, who has sort of become the poster boy for Chinese spying. Want to tell us a bit about what the congressman has become embroiled in? And is this sort of spying really endemic and typical of the Chinese these days?
He was the subject of what's called human intelligence. So a Chinese operative ingratiated themselves with him with the purpose of developing him either as a source of information or potentially as a way to influence government policy. It is classic spy technique. Keep remembering the very famous case that happened in England in the height of the Cold War when a British minister was having an affair with a woman who was directly reporting to a Soviet spy master. There's a long history of this, but to your point about the Chinese in the last, particularly in the last few years, the last 6 or 7 years, have really shifted over to using what's called human intelligence, which is there's a number of Chinese nationals in this country as students, as business people, as advocates and NGOs, and they have been used as operatives to either get information, get influence, or keep track of other Chinese nationals or in the country. So they have been developing a massive spy network because knowing that in the end, that is really the most effective way to get information. What's particularly interesting about Congressman Solow is two things. One is he's a member of the Intelligence Committee in Congress. Now, this is not a regular committee like the other ones because they do oversight of the Central Intelligence Agency and the intelligence community. They have access to the most secret information that the U.S. government has. Having a position in this committee is over and above the integrity and responsibility that we would expect from any congressional member. It's very, very important. And to have a member on that committee who, one, was compromised, and two, who we have legitimate questions about how forthright he's been about his relationship. I mean, to have the leader McCarthy, come out and say, look, I got the classified intelligence briefing on his relationship with this agent, and it leads me to believe that he should not be on this committee. That is very deeply disturbing. But it is kind of the one example of something the Chinese are doing all over the place. And what really concerns me is the response from the Biden team, the response from the leaders in the House, is to ignore the whole issue. I mean, here we have really emblematic of an incredible intelligence effort aimed at the United States, and they don't want to talk about it, and they don't want to apologize for it, and they don't want to hear about it. And I just think that's a horrible message to send to Americans about how they care about protecting us, and also what kind of message does that send to the Chinese when you refuse to call them out for spying?
That alone is cause for concern, but there are many other issues as well, Jim, where the Chinese are lying or deceiving the United States and the world for that matter. And one is going to be this area of so-called man-made climate change. And of course, the Biden administration, because that is a major issue for the left, is going to be placing an incredible amount of attention and emphasis on climate change and their so-called policy prescriptions for dealing with it. The Chinese, however, are a major cause of pollution, and they're not being honest with the rest of the world about their contribution to that problem either, are they?
No. As a matter of fact, it's another form of Chinese distraction. They came out and in the middle of COVID, and they said, we want to be the leaders, the global leaders on dealing with climate change. When the reality is, and of course, this is to Europeans and lots of people else that care about climate change. Oh, they go, isn't this wonderful? The Chinese care. Well, if the Chinese really cared, they wouldn't be the world's leading air polluter. Most of the plastic in the ocean comes from China. They have been decimating fisheries around the world. They have been destroying the water reserves of the Mekong Delta. They are the world's worst environmental abusers. And rather than holding them to task for their abhorrent behavior, the Chinese are acting like they're the leaders of environmental protection, which is laughable.
We have been talking with James Garofano, who is Vice President for Foreign Policy and Defense Studies at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., author of a new article, China Lies About Its Wrongdoing on COVID, Spying, Global Aggression, Pollution, and More. Jim, tell us where folks can go to read this article. Also, tell us a bit about the Heritage Foundation.
All of our materials available at the Heritage Foundation, heritage.org. It's the easiest place to find everything. And you know, Heritage is commonly called, it's a think tank, which means that we develop public policy solutions. But Heritage is really much more than that. Heritage is an enterprise that we have a lot of activities, and they're all designed for one purpose, to find ways to keep America free, safe, and prosperous. That's what we do.
James Garofano of the Heritage Foundation. Jim, thank you for being with us.
And thanks for having me.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, having a very busy time watching Congress these last few days, and much has happened, much has been done. Scott's going to explain it to us. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
We have the COVID relief measure passed. We have an omnibus spending bill passed. Before we get into discussing some of the issues and controversies, why don't you explain for us, Scott, what Congress has actually done?
Obviously, heading into the Christmas season, there's always a lot of pressure for Congress to get out of town and return to their families. And 2020 was no exception. I think that what we really saw here was a continued desire from members to use that credit card on a wish list of items that they wanted to ensure would pass this year and not have to go back to their state or their district without having passed coronavirus relief once again in 2020. And so this week we saw the Congress go ahead and pass a monstrosity of a bill. This bill was 5,593 pages long. And if you stand in front of a printer that can print 100 pages a minute, that's about 3 hours to print the entire bill. So you and I can guess exactly how many people actually read the thing.
In fact, it was unusual. Both Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is obviously one of the most left-wing members of Congress, and Senator Ted Cruz, one of the most conservative, they both actually agreed that this process just isn't done right.
To kind of fill in the listeners on what this process is of legislating, this is a negotiation among really five parties. It's the White House, the Senate Majority Leader's Office with Mitch McConnell, the Minority Leader's Office with Chuck Schumer, and then Nancy Pelosi, and very little to an extent, including Kevin McCarthy, the House Republican leader. And so when they come to an agreement like this, they're basically promising that they can deliver the votes that their leadership is built on. And that's exactly what they did. I think in the House, there were really only about 53 members that voted against the coronavirus relief package that ended up being combined with a large part of the funding for the non-defense discretionary federal agencies and appropriations. And they split the bill so that there could also be a vote on sort of the defense and police components of the federal government so that some of these left-wing members could vote against funding the police. And that vote ended up with about 40 Republicans voting no because of their fiscal concerns, and then about 40 Democrats voting no based on their concerns to be viewed by the progressive left as funding a bad criminal justice system. And so the House ended up doing a procedure to combine both those bills when they sent them over to the Senate. And the way that the Senate voted on everything, it was just one vote. And obviously, it passed real late at night, and only six United States senators voted in opposition, including zero Democrats.
Let's break this into two parts and talk, first of all, about this omnibus bill before we discuss what the details are of the COVID relief package. But for our listeners who may not be aware, what is an omnibus bill and why is Congress dealing with that at this particular time in the calendar?
An omnibus spending bill is basically what funds the federal government's day-to-day operations. And this one will fund the federal government through September 30th of 2021. It includes funding for all 12 bills that you would normally see in appropriations process. So generally, the federal government is broken out into 12 different categories and 12 different subcommittees of the Appropriations Committee. And Congress is supposed to consider each of those bills on its own. Sometimes they combine two or three, sometimes they combine six, sometimes they combine all 12. And what we saw in the House was eight bills and four bills and two different votes. But with the eight-bill package, that's what they tacked on the $900 billion coronavirus stimulus package to. Generally, these appropriation bills will include money for the Department of Health and Human Services. They'll include money for the NIH to continue to work on a vaccine, regular appropriations, and then the stimulus relief package is all emergency spending that's stacked on top of the budgetary authority that Congress has to go ahead and spend the American people's money. So really, these are bills that will keep the federal government open. We won't be talking about a shutdown for 9 months. But we still know that we're going to have a big fiscal debate heading into July of 2021 when the debt limit expires.
And, of course, the burgeoning national debt is another topic. We're going to talk more about that in the new year. But before we wrap up this segment, Scott, tell us a bit about this COVID relief bill. What is included in it?
Well, there's a lot of things included here. I think that what most listeners are hearing from the media is that there's $600 for every adult and additional money for children in the form of stimulus checks. This was a popular provision from the legislation that Congress passed earlier this spring to try to offset the economic harm that many Americans are facing due to the shutdowns in their local and state communities.
Well, a lot of stockings got stuffed by Congress. Compliments of future generations of taxpayers. We have been talking with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Going to be much, much more to talk about in the coming year. In the meantime, Scott, let's end up by having you tell us a bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization of over 500,000 Americans based in Washington, D.C. You can check us out on our website at clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Congress added some restrictions to parental school choice rights in that COVID-19 relief package. To learn more, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Corey DeAngelis of the Reason Foundation.
Governors will be prohibited from using emergency school funding to give families more educational options. That's thanks to a new provision inserted into that 5,600-page bill that Congress passed without having any time to read it earlier this week. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Corey DeAngelis. He is the director of school choice for the Reason Foundation. He's a colleague of mine. Corey, Merry Christmas and an early Happy New Year to you, and thanks for taking some time with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's talk about the gift, or I guess the many, many gifts that Congress is bestowing, of course, that we are paying for back to the American people. This new stimulus bill, it's still a little bit unsettled as we chat here on Wednesday morning. There's a chance that maybe the president actually blows this whole thing up. But there is a significant chunk of money in the new stimulus bill that's earmarked for education. There's a much smaller piece of that large chunk of money that is an emergency fund for governors, something that was created back during the CARES Act. And I guess we should start there. When that first stimulus bill was passed in March, there was this $3 billion pot of money that was created. And governors kind of got to do whatever they wanted with this, and some of them decided to pursue school choice programs with it.
Yeah, there was a handful of states, New Hampshire, Oklahoma, North Carolina, and South Carolina, and there might have been one other, but the governors decided to use some of that funding for funding students directly through school choice initiatives. For example, the Opportunity Scholarship Program in North Carolina, and I will say in South Carolina, though, although the governor wanted to do something with the money, the court struck it down. And I would argue that the whole argument of the court was incorrect in South Carolina. But that's a whole other conversation. But you're right that there were some of these states that were able to fund the students directly. But it's looking like that's not going to be the case with this round of stimulus.
Yeah, that's right. So now Congress goes back and there's another round of stimulus. They put more money. I think it's $2.75 billion. That's a drop in the bucket compared to what we actually spend on traditional public schools in this country. But at least it's some money here in this governor's emergency relief fund, emergency education relief fund. But this time around, there's like these new caveats on how governors are allowed to use this money. And it seems like it's driven by a response to those four states that you were just talking about.
Yeah, they don't want states to do that this time around. And I will say this is about 5% of the total funds that are allocated for K-12 education. The other 95% goes to traditional public schools. So about $50 billion going to the traditional public schools, which is about how much the federal government already invests in the traditional public school system each year, at least at the federal level. And so this is, this is allowed to go to non-public schools or private schools, but it's only allowed to go to institutions. Now it can't go to choice programs to fund students directly, and I think that's the best way to do it. I don't want the money to go to institutions, period, or at least a large fraction of the money should go to students rather than the buildings. So you have 5% of the money going to private buildings. You got 95% of the money going to public buildings, and then the students are kind of getting the short end of the stick, and so are the families. And I mean, this is kind of what we're seeing overall with the stimulus bill this time around as well. You know, they're talking about the $600 checks for people, whereas you're having tons of bailouts for major corporations and other nations even.
Yeah, that's a good point. Just sort of it does reflect the larger strategy here of Congress. And all the attention is on those stimulus checks, whether it ends up being $600 or whether it's $2,000 like the president has come out and said he wants. Regardless, there's a lot of money in this bill that is not that direct funding. And the same is true of education. It's a lot of money here that goes to those institutions, as you said, Corey, and not to the families, not to parents, not to students. We are talking with Corey DeAngelis. He is the director of school choice at the Reason Foundation. Got a few minutes left with him here. I want to change gears just before we let you go here, because the Trump administration looks like it's probably coming to an end. We're going to have President Joe Biden here next month. And that's, you know, as any time when you have a changeover of presidential administrations, that means policies change. It means the people setting policies change. Like, give us a little bit of a sense, if you can, of what the Biden administration means for school choice and for educational opportunity.
Well, it sounds like they want to defund a lot of the public charter schools. At least they want to take away the federal funding of for-profit charter schools, which only tends to be around 12 to 15% of all charter schools. But that's still a significant chunk of schools that could go under that are serving families right now if at the margins taking away that funding causes them to shutter. And then also in a recent conversation with the Biden's national policy director, Steph Feldman, with the Education Writers Association, they asked her what their thoughts were on charter schools and what they're going to do with them. The policy director said that they were going to defund, quote-unquote, underperforming charter schools, or at least charter schools that don't provide results in their view. And they didn't really say what they meant by results, even after asked by the reporter. But then when it came to the traditional public schools, the national policy director actually said they just needed more money. And what's interesting there is that charter schools already tend to get less money than traditional public schools. So it just goes to show you that the underperforming charter schools, they're going to punish them by taking their money, but underperforming traditional schools, they just want to throw more resources at the problem. It just shows you their differences in priorities and how they deal with these different sectors.
Yeah, I am just so tired of that double standard. You see that all the time, and it's unfortunate that it looks like we're going to see more of that in the Biden administration. I guess, once again, this is an argument for why education policy should be, and mostly is, set at the state level, because then you don't have a new presidential administration just stripping away all of that. We are unfortunately out of time. That's a whole other discussion for another day. Corey, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, that is Corey DeAngelis. He is the director of school choice for the Reason Foundation. He is an excellent resource on educational policy. You can find him and follow him on Twitter, where he is prolific and an excellent follow. Highly recommend that you do that. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out our coverage of the outgoing Trump administration, the incoming Biden administration, and everything else that's in the news at Reason.com. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
The U.S. Supreme Court had before it the opportunity to bring about some closure to the contested presidential election, but failed to take up the case. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, says it could have been a King Solomon moment on this American Radio Journal commentary.
On December 11, 2020, the United States Supreme Court ruled in the state of Texas lawsuit versus the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania et al., and I quote, "The state of Texas motion for leave to file a bill of complaint is denied for lack of standing under Article 3 of the Constitution. Texas has not demonstrated a judicially cognizable interest in the manner in which another state conducts its elections. All other pending motions are dismissed as moot," end quote. The issue ceased to be about President Trump or former Vice President Biden, but instead it has become about the perspective of the governed as to the justice of the election. "We the people received no resolution, no vindication, no solution, no justice, and candidly, no answer. The case was a seminal one. It was a case in which the actions taken by the Supreme Court would determine our destiny as a republic. It was a Boston Tea Party moment in virtually every respect. With the Boston Tea Party, citizens had gotten to the point of losing faith and trust in those governing. The people responded and a nation was born. In our current situation in 2020, no matter what happens, the United States Supreme Court has refused to act, and 50% of the citizens in the nation are guaranteed to believe that justice has not been served. We needed a resolution of the perceived inequities in the election, not a bureaucratic response. The very survival of our republic was at stake. 4 more years of the type of dissent that we have had in this nation for over 20 years, and most recently in the last 4, and will ensure that our nation will not heal, and nor will we fare well if an adversary seeks to take advantage of our discord during the process." These now famous words from our own Declaration of Independence should serve as a stark reminder of what is at stake with the governed, half of whom distrust the very election processes upon which our liberties are based. And I quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure those rights, government are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles, and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to their effect, safety and happiness. Our Declaration of Independence states that we have certain inalienable rights. Those rights are not just words. They mean something, especially to those who served in the military, supporting and defending our Constitution and our liberties. Our government is based upon the trust of the governed. When trust is lost, so is the basis of our republic, and that cannot stand. This republic of ours is too precious a gift to discard. We must work diligently to preserve our liberties for all citizens. Trust, once lost, is almost impossible to regain. The concept of liberty recognizes our rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Liberty includes those unalienable rights given to all created. Freedom implies the ability to act, such as our freedoms of speech, religion, assembly, and to bear arms. The minute one's freedoms trample on the liberty of another, then conflict ensues and must be resolved. Our nation is at a crossroads. The Supreme Court needed to be the guardians of a republic at a time when it was needed most. I do empathize with the justices, for the magnitude of their decision was immense. Unfortunately, however, no decision is a decision. No decision will sow 4 more years of abject contempt, desperation, anger, retaliation, and discord from those who feel disenfranchised. Trust will be forever lost, and perhaps never regained. This is no longer about President Trump. This is not about Vice President Biden. This is about people being heard and having trust, faith, and belief in the government that we have chosen to represent us. This was a seminal moment, and we failed. January 20, 2021 will soon be before us. The swearing of the next president will take place, but the discord will remain. No solutions will have been offered. I wrote the brief of my concerns about the election in Pennsylvania, for instance. I stated in that brief, which the state of Texas considered in their brief entitled The Ryan Report, and I quote, "The general election of 2020 in Pennsylvania was so fraught with inconsistencies, documented irregularities and improprieties associated with mail-in balloting, pre-canvassing and canvassing, that the reliability of the mail-in votes of the Commonwealth in Pennsylvania is impossible to rely on. The above factors, when combined with the lack of required internal control mechanisms to ensure legality, accountability, accuracy, and trustworthiness of the results, effectively undermine the trustworthiness of the entire election process," end quote. The remedies for the Supreme Court would have taken immense courage. A full-scale investigation and audit would be a rational mandate from the court. Doing nothing was perhaps the worst of all possible solutions. With nothing decided, nothing is likewise resolved. And it is guaranteed that 50% of the population at a minimum will not trust the election results. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KIOU-AM in Shreveport, Louisiana, WASG-AM in Mobile, Alabama, along with WDZY-AM in Richmond, Virginia. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.